ministers of the gospel of Christ is to not only first plant our own feet on higher ground, but in some way say things, do things that would help others to do the same thing, because I believe that each of us desire to do that. I just have an idea that there is not a single individual here this morning that would not like to walk on a higher plane in life, to experience God in your life, to really feel and to really believe there is a God in heaven and that you can communicate with Him. That if you strive in your way to serve Him, you will benefit by walking and enjoying that walk on a higher plane. The world cannot afford to us any real joy or happiness in the low areas of life. I know this to be true. I care not what the activities we are engaged in. There is only one real and satisfying joy that will last, that will endure, that will be abiding. And that is when you know the joy of communication, association with God and with His Son, Jesus Christ. I hope today to not only direct my remarks to we who have taken the name of Christ and are supposed to be Christians. I hope to share with you who have not embraced this gospel of Christ as well some things that hopefully will create a desire within you to walk on a higher plane. But I am mindful of the fact that you'll have to take it from there. There is something you will have to do if you are to indeed walk on a higher plane than you have henceforth been walking. I work at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Oak Ridge. We attend many meetings there. I don't attend so many, but many meetings there occur, and on occasion I attend some, and many speeches are made. On one occasion, I heard a speaker make this statement: if you want to make a good speech, begin by telling the people what you're going to tell them, and then tell them, and then tell them what you told them. I believe this would be very lengthy if I were to try to do that. However, I picked up a thought there, and I think sometimes we are very confused, or confusing, I would say, in terms of trying to present to our people what we're trying to say. And I'm going to at least to try to outline briefly what I hope I'm going to say. Now, I have thought in times past that in my mind I have these thoughts running around, and I want to get up here, and all of these thoughts that I have, I want to in some way bring them together and present all of them. And in times past, I've gotten just a few thoughts across, and I begin to wander and digress and this, that, and the other, and the first thing I know, the time is gone and I haven't covered the ground I thought I would. So if I began by saying this is what I'm going to tell you, and don't really tell you that, well, don't really think that I've purposely lied to you. These are the thoughts that I have in mind. I want to rehearse in our minds, we who are members of this church, some of the reasons why I feel we believe. Believe what? Believe this restored gospel of Jesus Christ. We have something called the Book of Mormon. And not too long ago, my son-in-law, who has only been my son-in-law for about 2 years, asked me the question, why do you people believe the Book of Mormon? And I thought, well, now that's a good question. You know, I mean, here is a fella that's joined our family. He's really never been exposed to it. He has been strictly Bible-oriented during his life. And that's a natural question. And, you know, I think sometimes if we want to learn, if we want to try to plant our feet upon higher ground, if we don't know a thing, we should ask a question. Why in the world do you believe this or that? What makes you think this or that? And, you know, if it's asked in the right attitude, I believe that's just the thing to do. Because if we cannot give answer of the hope that lies within us, we better start searching for the answer. Now, that's just the way it is. And I invite all to challenge us as members of this Church of Christ who claim that God has indeed restored the gospel to the earth, to challenge us and to ask us why we believe that. Because it's a good question. And let's get busy and try to find out why we believe. And why ask ourselves questions and try to determine, could we answer that question should someone ask us? We have written, I want to begin now with this thought of trying to present why we believe certain things. I want to begin by the use of the 8th chapter of Isaiah. Those of you who have Bibles that wish to follow some of this, I'll try to give the references as I go along. 8th chapter of Isaiah. I want to read the 19th verse, but emphasize the 20th verse. In the 19th verse, "And when they shall say unto you, seek unto them that have familiar spirits, and unto wizards that peep and mutter, should not a people seek unto their God?" Now, we have today those who are claiming this or that. If you want to know the truth of what? Well, just truth. Well, in our Sunday school this morning, we were talking about what might be truth in terms of the agricultural things we see around us, the animal life, the how this world came into existence. We want to find out what truth is. And now we have in our world today those who speak in terms of if you'll just meditate in some way, you can kind of, in some transitorial type maneuvering, your mind can wander throughout the universe and search out and find out what truth is. We have that advocated today. And we have those who believe that the astrological signs have something to say to you, and all you have to do is research this type of science and you will find out what your destination is in life. And you can check with the Ouija board and find out a few things they tell us. And some people over here will say, listen to me, I have the truth. And others will say this. Brother so-and-so of this church, even Joe Kidd, might say to you, I think I understand truth. But what is truth, and where do we find it? I refer you to the following verse in the 20th chapter, or the 8th chapter in the 20th verse of Isaiah. To the law and to the testimony. If they, who are they? That's anyone that says, I know the truth, and I have the truth, and here's where you can find it. If they speak not according to this word, it is because there is no light in them. We have two things by which we can measure truth. If this is an inspired record, it says we must check with the law and with the testimony. And if they speak not according to these things, it's because there is no light in them. I want to refer to the 49th chapter of Genesis. I think we will discover here what the law is. The 49th chapter of Isaiah, here's the blessing given to Judah, beginning with the 8th verse. Judah, Thou art he whom thy brethren shall praise, thy hand shall be in the neck of thine enemies, thy father's children shall bow down before thee. Judah is a lion's whelp, from the prey, my son, thou art gone up. He stooped down, he couched as a lion, and as an old lion, who shall rouse him up? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh come, and unto him shall the gathering of the people be. It was unto Judah that held that baton, that emblem of authority, representing the authority of what truth is. And it was through Judah that the law came. The lawgiver came through his seed. And even so, Christ was of the house of Judah. So we discover here what the law is. Now, the eighth chapter of Isaiah speaks of the testimony. Now, what is the testimony? Now, remember, we're not speaking of just a testimony. Some brother might give a testimony, but here is something, there's something known in the scriptures as the testimony. I know of no other record, no other authoritative scripture that claims that it is witnessing, it is testifying to the truthfulness of the record of Judah, unless it be the Book of Mormon. And you know, the Book of Mormon is indeed a testimony to that truthfulness. And we find right here in this Book of Mormon, beginning real early in the fourth part of the book, and if you haven't ever read the Book of Mormon, I invite you to do so. Because you will discover real soon that wherein Lehi and Nephi saw visions of the future, and they saw that one day the Gentiles who were over in the old country, how they were separated from the seed of his brethren here, there would be a man so inspired of God that would move over, and people would come with him, and they would have in their hands a book. And this scripture here says that that book would be of great worth unto the Gentile nations here. And it further told us that this book proceeded forth from the mouth of a Jew. And we believe that Jew was Christ. We have an idea that that man was Columbus, and those pilgrims that came over here did indeed have this record, this law. And so we have no problem identifying what the testimony is. I want to skip about, I hope to, even though the subject matter might be somewhat fragmented, I hope that we will place it all in the contents of the question, why I believe. We have, let's see, maybe I should turn to a blessing given to Joseph. Well, that was about where I was. I'll just turn back over there. We believe, by the way, that this land on which we live, according to the words written in the Book of Mormon, is Joseph's land. We believe that the blessings, excuse me, identified in the scripture identifies this land. It tells us a little bit why we believe this is Joseph's land and what was to happen in Joseph's land. Now, going back for a moment to the 49th chapter of Genesis, and beginning now with the 22nd verse, we find this. Joseph is a fruitful bough, even a fruitful bough by a well, whose branches run over the wall. We might ask the question, and it would be a good question, what is the wall? Now, we've talked about the testimony. Now, we're not talking about just any wall here, are we? Now, the old country, we know, had to build walls around their places of residence, their cities and so forth, because there were constantly those marauding armies that were coming in to attack and take over. And they had to build walls. As a sidelight, the scriptures do refer to a place of unwalled villages. We believe that to be this land. But over there, the order of the day is to build walls. Now, Joseph's branches he is a fruitful bough, and whose branches run over the wall. We go over to the book of Nahum and find out what the wall might be. It's talking about the city of Nineveh. You remember Nineveh. That's the place where Jonah was sent to preach. And it speaks of Nineveh is laid waste. Who will bemoan her? Whence shall I seek comforters for thee? Art thou better than populace? No, that was situate among the rivers, that had the waters round about it, whose rampart was the sea, and her wall was from the sea. You see, the sea was the wall. It was the wall that was very difficult to cross. Just any wall wasn't too difficult to cross. And the people could get over the walls. They could build all kinds of things to reach up and get over those walls. But here Nineveh has in back of her what is known in Scripture as the wall. It's that great body of water. It would be very difficult for anybody to climb over the back fence in this case and get to Nineveh unless they cross the entire water. And so here we find then in our understanding that if this is true, if what I have said thus far is true, then I am led to believe that Joseph's seed came over this wall, this ocean. And all we have to do is pick up this Book of Mormon and it tells us that that's what happened. Going on a bit in the 49th chapter, let's see, I'll read a little more of the following verses. His bow abode in strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. And I believe that's true in terms of this land. God has made this nation strong. He has made Joseph's seed strong in terms of not only this land, but the seed of Joseph in the land across the pond. Even by the God of thy father who shall help thee, and by the Almighty who shall bless thee with blessings of heaven above. He is going to bless Joseph's land with blessings of heaven above. We believe God has done that. What do we claim that God has blessed Joseph's seed with in terms of coming down from heaven above? Well, we believe the gospel was restored right here on this continent, do we not? We believe that an angel appeared to this continent. We believe that God and his son Jesus Christ appeared to Joseph Smith and so identified these things to us. Blessings of heaven above, if that is true, it's not that blessings of heaven above. Now, continuing on, we have a little more information. The blessings of thy father have prevailed above the blessings of my progenitors unto the utmost bound of the everlasting hills. What does utmost mean? It's a place situated at the farthest or most distant point. Joseph's blessing was to extend to the most farthest or distant point. From what point? We have to have a point of reference. Well, the point we're in, at the location where he resided at that time. You take a globe of the world, put your finger where he was standing long about that time, and go around the globe to the furthest or most distant point of the everlasting hills, and see what the other finger is pointing to, and it'll be pointing to the land of America. If you want to try it the other direction, you go around the other way and see if your finger isn't pointing about the same spot. Joseph's blessing extended beyond the land of Palestine. It was unto the utmost bound of the everlasting hills. Thank you, Ron. They shall be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the hem that was separated from his brethren. Joseph, we know, in Egypt was separated from his brethren. I am inclined to believe that all of those things that happened there are types and shadows of that which was to come. And I incline to believe that there was some significance in the fact that Joseph at that time was separated from his brethren, because that's the way it is now in terms of being separated from the old country all the way over here in terms of his seed. And so we can make connections if we just want to do that, and I believe there's some logic and reasoning behind it. Now that was the blessing given by Jacob to his son Joseph. Later on there was a man named Moses, and he had something to say in terms of blessings to these same boys, Joseph being one to whom he gave the blessings. And let's compare what Moses said in light of what Jacob said. I want to read it. Deuteronomy 33, chapter, verse 13. And of Joseph, he said, "Blessed of the Lord be his land." Joseph was to have a land that was to be blessed, a blessed land. You go over to the land of Palestine, and that portion assigned to Joseph there was no better than any other assignment given to any other of the children of Israel. It's no better. Look it over if you're ever there and see if you can find anything in that land that assigned to Joseph is superior in any way. We must search for the land of Joseph that is a better land. And it has some descriptions here of Joseph's land. Now we thus determined that that land, in addition to the assignment over there, can be a land over here known as the United States of America. "Blessed be the Lord, blessed of the Lord be his land, for the precious things of heaven." Here comes the precious things of heaven again, and there cannot be any more precious things of heaven than what this land has already received. Revelation from God, the restoration of the gospel of Christ. Christ has been here. God himself has visited here and identified his son Jesus Christ and said, "Hear him." And it's up to us today to hear these things, because he, we believe, has inspired this law and this testimony. "For the precious things of heaven, for the dew and for the deep that coucheth beneath." For the dew and the deep that coucheth beneath. We're talking about moisture content that helps a land to have great abundance of agricultural products, are we not? Now, you over in the old land, you know, those folks over there just had to search to find a good well. They would dig and dig. We have in the scriptures where Jacob had a pretty good well, and people all around came and wanted to get water out of that well. But you know, it hadn't been that difficult here in Joseph's land that was blessed with the dew and the deep that coucheth beneath. Why, our old farmers and pilgrims of this land dug wells all over this continent and found good water. And this land has been wonderfully blessed beyond any land. You take a look and try to find the same type of water in these other countries that yet you found here in Joseph's land, and you will not find it so. "And for the precious fruits brought forth by the sun, and for the precious things put forth by the moon." We're talking about agricultural. And you know, this nation has been blessed economically primarily, I would say, because of our tremendous powers of agriculture. Well, the great nation of Russia still tries to buy wheat from us. But of course, as this nation transgresses, we know other things begin to fade away as well, including these things we're talking about now. "For the chief things of the ancient mountains," this land was blessed also because of the chief things of the ancient mountains, such as coal and some other mineral wealths and so forth that we know are chief things of our ancient mountains. "And for the precious things of the lasting hills." What are the precious things of our lasting hills that we're talking about? Where can we find a land that has a lot of precious things of the lasting hills? And what are those precious things? It's gold, it's silver, it's these things. And you know, I remember reading something called the The Facts for the Times. This was a book recorded many years ago, and I can recall the page number it referred to. Page 110, it listed, in terms of some precious things, namely gold, and contrasted the amount of gold that this nation produced in contrast to the old country. And I can recall this, that it said that total Europe, at the discovery of America, had produced $60 million of gold. That was the total amount. And we have in this same book of facts the information that California and the surrounding territories produced 100 thousand millions of dollars of gold in 20 years. And in 1 year time, it produced 90 millions of dollars. In more than 1 year, it produced 90 million dollars of gold. And so does this land that on which we live, has it had the precious things of the everlasting hills? Yes, it's true that Australia produced a great amount of gold. But it's also true that the most gold that Australia ever produced was 61 millions of gold in 1 year. And California has produced several times 90 million dollars of gold in 1 year. This is the land of Joseph as identified in the scriptures. These things are true. We don't have to go on blind faith. All we have to do is scratch around a little and find that treasure that God has spoken of. The kingdom of heaven is like a treasure. And you're not going to find this treasure lying around on the ground. You're going to have to dig for it. You're going to have to search these things out for yourself. I can stand here and say, this is what I believe. This is why I believe it. And I can refer you to the scriptures. But you're going to have to go to God yourself. You're going to have to read these things yourself. And you're going to have to ask God, is Joe Kidd speaking with a forked tongue? Or is he not? I want to know the truth. Do you believe there is a God, and do you believe that he can give you this information? This book says that if you ever come in contact with it, you read it, you ask God if it's true, and if you ask with a sincere heart and belief, if you do your part, it'll be told you. But you have something to do. Yes, the precious things of the everlasting hills, and for the precious things of the earth and the fullness thereof, and for the goodwill of him that dwelt in the bush. Well, who dwelt in the bush? We know Moses went up to the burning bush, and there's somebody dwelling in there, and it was God. And God has given his goodwill to this land, and we know that he gave his goodwill to these people when they came over here. And we have some information here in this Book of Mormon telling us that when these pilgrims came over here, they humbled themselves, but it wasn't long till their mother Gentiles made war with them. And you know what this Book of Mormon says? It says that God was with them and helped them to win that battle. And you take anybody that knows anything about war and the strategy of war, and they are amazed that this little group of people, this people that came over here at that time, was able to survive that war because of the total powers of Europe that came against them. You think we don't have information or evidence or reasons why we believe these things? Are they not worthy of our investigation? Yes. Something else in the 49th chapter or the 33rd chapter of Deuteronomy in terms of the blessing as given through Moses. His glory, that's Jacob's glory, that's this continent, is going to be like the firstling of a bullock, and his horns are like the horns of unicorns. With them he shall push the people together to the end of the earth. Now identify what people we're talking about. Take a look at history. Who's done this? Now, I don't know whether any of you have ever seen a unicorn or not. I haven't. I've seen pictures of what some people say this is what they look like. And it had one large horn coming out of the forehead. I believe, really, that's a pretty good portrayal of really the truth of the matter, because I do believe that Joseph through the years has been united in terms of war power. the power that he has to make war, and I believe that's what a horn symbolizes. It symbolizes the power to make, to fight or to make war, if that beast, if that animal is a soul of the mind to do. And you know, some of the other beasts in that are identified in the scripture, some had more than one horn, but they also had more than one king. And this Roman Empire that was broken up into 10 kingdoms finally had 10 horns. And so they had 10 little separate powers to make war and so forth. But here, Joseph has a military power. And with that power, apparently, he had just what that horn was just long enough and strong enough to push the people together from the ends of the earth. And you know, you take a look at history, and there is no people that I know of that's identified other than what we claim to be Joseph's seed that has been able to do this. Among the part of Joseph over the old country, we believe to be England. And of course, England at one time, I guess their horn reached out and was pushing people together in the far corners of the earth over there, and we were lending a hand. But of course, transgression has befallen us, and this sort of thing is subsiding. But this is what has happened here. Now that helps us to believe. That helps to give us an answer as to why we believe these things. I want to skip over now, and as I say, I'm going to be speaking in with just broken fragments, but I hope all of these things are going to unite to tell the same story. Isaiah 29th chapter. It's familiar with many of us, we know, but I think if we will be patient, consider these things, ask God to enlighten me a little bit as I go on, I think it'll be helpful to us who have read it many times. Might be helpful to those who are here that might wonder why we believe what we do. 29th chapter, Isaiah. Woe unto Ariel, the city where David dwelt, add ye year to year, let them still kill sacrifices, yet I'm going to distress her, God is saying. This city where David dwelt was Jerusalem, and God is saying, I am going to distress that place, and he is saying, I will camp against thee round about and lay siege against thee with a mountain. I will raise forts against thee, and thou shalt be brought down. You're going to be brought down, Jerusalem. I'm going to lay siege against you. I'm going to do all of these things. And then here comes some peculiar language. Here's what's going to happen after that happens. Thou shalt speak out of the ground. Now, isn't that funny? Isn't that strange? How in the world can a nation, can a large city speak out of the ground after God has done these things? Well, we believe we have the answer. I give it for your consideration as we continue on. Thy speech shall be low out of the dust, and thy voice shall be of one that hath a familiar spirit. Yes, we believe. We believe that Lehi was a man who lived in this city we're talking about right here. And we believe, I'm getting the information from the Book of Mormon, by the way. We believe that Lehi lived there, and God appeared to him and told him just what he's threatening to do here in the 29th chapter of Isaiah. And he says, now you leave this place, take your family with you. I'm going to direct you to a better place. They came over here, this continent. They crossed that wall of which we spoke a little earlier. Now, in some way, then, we're trying to find out how they can speak out of the ground. Now, I'm going to tell you first how, and then we'll read some more. We believe that this people that came over here had a record. They told about what had happened over there, the destruction that was to take place, and they told us a lot of other things in terms of history. And yet they were destroyed. Their record was buried in the earth. And finally it came forth when God restored this gospel of Christ to this earth. And here it is, coming to us as the words of that people speaking out of the ground, for that's where it was buried for many years. Moreover, the multitude of thy strangers shall be like small dust, and the multitude of terrible ones shall be as chaff that passeth away. Yea, it shall be in an instant suddenly, and thou shalt be visited of the Lord of hosts with thunder and with earthquakes, and with great noise, with storm, tempest, flame of devouring fire, and so forth, I'm going to do all this to Jerusalem. And you know what he says? I'm going to skip down because I want to be brief and to the point. He skips down and he says, all of this now that I've told you are going to be as, it's going to be, here's the way he puts it, in the vision of all. The vision of all of what? All that we've been talking about. The vision of all is become unto you as the words of a book. Now, remember, he doesn't say as the book, but just words of the book. And that point is significant, as we'll find out. That is sealed, which men deliver to one that is learned, saying, read this, I pray thee, and he saith, I cannot, for it is sealed. We know in our history, Martin Harris took not the book, but just the words of that book to Professor Anthon. And after some exchange of thought and so forth, he gave him some certificate indicating this is a valid translation and so forth. Where's the rest of it? How'd you get it? Well, it's a religious work. Professor Anthon says, I don't believe in angels. I don't believe in that type of thing. Let me see the receipt. And he tore it up, you know, and that sort of thing. He says, I can't read the sealed book because Martin Harrison told him the rest of it was sealed. Direct fulfillment of this. And then, after that, the book is delivered to him that is not learned, saying, read this, I pray thee, and he saith, I am not learned. This is not the words of the book. This is the book was delivered to him that is not learned. Who in history received the book who was not learned to interpret it? Well, we believe there's a historical figure that had the name Joseph Smith. He made the claim. We believe it. We have the book. We have researched that book. We've had others to research that book. We've had people to take critical looks at that book and tried to kill everything that's in there in terms of what their research has been. They've been unable to do it. This book was given, we believe, by the inspiration of God, and we see the fulfillment. And I say, if Joseph Smith didn't fulfill this prophecy, you find the man and give him the name, the place, the circumstances that will fulfill this. Find it. We have a responsibility to check these things out. It's our responsibility to find out truth is. If we want to know the truth, you have to do your part in soul checking. Let's go on a little further. Wherefore the Lord said, for as much as this people draw near with their mouth and with their lips do honor me, but with their but have removed their heart far from me, and their fear toward me is taught by the precepts of men. And I want to pause right there, because when this book came forward, do you remember what precepts were taught at that time in terms of the fear of God? Do you? Now that's when the hellfire damnation preachers were just really pouring it on. Now that's how the fear of God was taught when this record came forth. And, well, let me read one other thing before I comment further. Therefore, behold, I will proceed to do a marvelous work among this people, even a marvelous work and a wonder, for the wisdom of the wise men shall perish, and the understanding of the prudent men shall be hid. And you know, that type of preaching has very much subsided since the coming forth of this great and wonderful revelation of God to us, because the precepts of men, even in most of the churches of the earth today, is not taught in that fashion. They do not tell you. I remember some man sometime tried to graphically portray the heat and the torment that God was going to pour out upon the wicked by saying, he has these blast furnaces, and he's going to throw you in this one here, and it's going to be several millions of degrees hot, and by the time you get all warmed up there, you're transferred into a hotter one, and this just goes on throughout all eternity, you see. Now, I realize this is a little laughable, but I am saying this, that type of precept, in terms of trying to teach the people the fear of God, that's how it was handled then. And you know, we know that if it's correct, if a person is going to have fearful, not only fear, but respect and reverence to God, it not only comes in terms of that he's going to spank me if I don't behave, but we're going to find reason to believe that he's our friend, that he loves us, even though we err. And that's the type of precept that I believe that will cause men to not only fear God, but to respond to God. And so this type thing was going to be hid and so forth. And that's the type thing, that's the type precept that was made at that time. Now we have one other thought before I move away from chapter 29 of Isaiah. The scriptures identify to us when this was going to happen. This what? Well, when the words of this book was going to come forth that represented the vision of all of this and indicates that the precepts at this time were going to have these precepts being taught. And here's what it says. It's going to come forth wherein it states it's just going to be a little while until Lebanon shall be turned into a fruitful field, and the fruitful field shall be esteemed as a forest. It's going to come to our point in time when it's just going to be a little while, and Lebanon is going to be returned into a fruitful field. What is Lebanon? Check it out. It's Palestine. Let's take a look at history. When did this record come to us? About 1830. When did Lebanon become a fruitful field? Approximately 20, 22, 23 years later. The former and latter rains were there in 1853, and I've read some accounts where at least either the former or the latter was there as early as 1851. I'm not sure of that. But here's the point. For hundreds of years, that land received no rain. Now, God told us about what he was going to do there. We're not at a loss to wonder why, because the people transgressed. And they got out of the way, and God says, I'm going to scatter you, and I'm going to fix your land up to where it's not even worthy of habitation. These are my words, of course. And you know, history tells us he did that. All we have to do is look at the accounts. Do we have reason to believe, or do we not? Now, we find some accounts wherein the natives were just simply astonished when that rain began to return. I don't want to delay here. I want to rush on here. My time is just about gone, and I'm going to have to get with it here a little bit if I'm going to cover much more ground at all. We have this information that, to me, is just tremendous evidence. We don't have to run on blind faith. We just have it right here. And as I say, you folks challenge these people here. Go to the local ministry here and say, why do you believe this? And don't think they're going to get mad at you because you challenge them. I don't think they will. We have something else recorded in the 37th chapter of Ezekiel. And I want to comment on that just a little bit. Because we believe that this identifies that there is to be two records. We've already talked about it, but this is going to help us to understand it further. 37th chapter of Ezekiel. The hand of the Lord was upon me and carried me out in the spirit of the Lord and set me down in the midst of the valley which was full of bones and caused me to pass by them round about, and behold, they were very many in the open valley, and lo, they were very dry. Now, they're in a valley. They're in a lowland. We thought we sang a song about some high land that we wanted to get on. Somehow, they drifted down into the lowland. And you know, moisture content is not only life to the botanical world, but it's life to the spiritual world as well. Because the scriptures tell me that a certain man that is a certain way is likened to a tree planted by the water. And you know, in one place, then we're given to understand that the Spirit of God is likened unto water that nourishes the heart, as well as some other significant thoughts. Now, so these bones are very dry. They're in a lowland. We're going to find out what these bones represent. I'm going to tell you ahead of time, and then we'll get there and see if that's not correct. All of these bones are symbolic of all the house of Israel. They transgressed God's laws, and they dried up. And they're down in a low valley. And then God is showing Ezekiel just what is happening here to this house of Israel. And he's trying to draw a graphic picture to him, showing him just how spiritually dry they are and how what kind of an elevation that they're walking on. And he said unto me, Son of man, can these bones live? Now, you've got a whole house here that's died, and that's a very good question, isn't it? After they've died, can they live? And he said unto me, Son of man, can these bones live? And I answered and said, Lord, thou knowest. Well, you know, if you ask me that question, I think I'd just put the question right back to him as he did. Well, you know the answer to that. You know, I don't really know. Again, he said unto me, prophesy unto these bones and say unto them, O ye dry bones, hear the word of the Lord. And you know, there's a song that I remember on that. But here God has told Ezekiel, you prophesy because I'm going to tell you some truth about these dry bones. Thus saith the Lord God unto these bones, behold, I will cause breath to enter into you, and you are going to live. And I will lay sinews upon you, and bring flesh upon you, and cover you with skin, and put breath in you, and you will live, and you will know that I am the Lord. Now we're talking about the whole house of Israel. Now all of this isn't fulfilled yet. I prophesied, and I commanded, and I prophesied, and there was a noise, and behold, there was shaking bone came to his bone. We're talking about a gathering. Now we're going to notice as we get a little further that when those bones were gathered and set in place, they still didn't have any life. And you know, I believe that's the way it's going to be in the gathering of the total house of Israel. When they're first gathered, there's no really spiritual life in there. And you know, that's the way it is over in Palestine today. There's a lot of gathering over there. They don't have any spiritual life in them. But some of the bones are beginning to come together, aren't they? Okay, come, and behold, I will put sinews and flesh upon you, and so forth, and then he is going to cause breath to come into them, and they will live. Now, that part is yet to be fulfilled, but I believe it. We see evidence of the bones coming together, yet all of the bones are not in place. Remember, the total Christian community is likened unto a body. We understand that to be one of the precepts of the gospel of Christ. So it's not unusual that this graphic picture painted here by God to Ezekiel is in terms of material that makes up a body. Bones, flesh, sinews, all these things. I've scattered them in the past, and they're dry, and they're in the valley, but I'm going to cause these things to come together, and they're going to live. And he said unto me, prophesy unto the wind, and he caused breath to enter into them. I'm going to have to skip down some of this. But here, I want to point out this one verse, the 11th verse. Then he said unto me, son of man, these bones are the whole house of Israel. So don't take my word for it. That's what the Bible says. That's just exactly what those bones represent, the whole house of Israel. Now, he comes on down in terms of, now, keep in mind the background. Because we painted here a picture that's sort of on a parallel with what Isaiah had to say. I'm going to distress you. I'm going to cause all these things. You're going to be brought down, he said over in Isaiah. And you're going to speak out of the dust. And you know, that's the way these bones are, isn't it? If these bones are brought down, you kill somebody, and he's going to be not quite as tall as he was before, because he's just going to be spread out all over the ground. And that's the way the whole house of Israel was in terms of spiritual stature. Now, he comes on down, the 16th verse, moreover, thou son of man. Now, God is going to try to institute something that's going to help get the job done, to restore and bring back to life, and to cause these bones to come together and life to come into them. He's going to begin to tell us some of the things that he's going to do to cause this to happen. Now, you take a stick and write upon it for Judah, he says. And the children of Israel, his companions, take another stick and write upon it for Joseph, the stick of Ephraim, for all the house of Israel and his companions. Well, we have two sticks here. Briefly, we know that the old stick of the law was actually on pieces of wood made in what we might call sticks, yet shaped to hold that scroll. As you would unroll one, roll the other, you could read it. These were sticks of the law. That's before we had books. Printing presses and that type thing, covers and so forth. Their books were not books as we know them now, but they were sticks. And so he's saying, yeah, you make one book here called a stick, and you write up on it for Judah, and you take the other one and for Joseph. Now we know, we talked about already concerning the law and the testimony, what we believe to be the law and what the testimony. And here we believe that again, this verifies the fact that Joseph's record, Joseph's stick, is here. If it isn't here, we pose the question, where is it? Now, is that a good question or not? If this isn't Joseph's stick, where is it? You investigate. You challenge us. Find another stick. You see, we have reason to believe these things. Join them together into one stick, and they shall become one in mine hand. And that's where they're supposed to be today. When we preach from the pulpit, we are to use both. I'm going to have to just rush here just a little more. I would like to talk about that a little more, but I want to refer to a couple of other things, and I'm going to have to, I guess, cut it short because I don't want to tire you. There is something in terms, and I just want to bring this one thought out plus one other. God has said that he has written unto Ephraim, who, by the way, is one of the children, one of the sons of Joseph. He has written unto him, let me give you the reference, Hosea, the 8th chapter, and I'm reading now with the 11th verse. Because Ephraim hath made many altars to sin, they shall be unto him to sin. 12th verse, I have written unto him the great things of my law. I have written unto him the great things of my law, and I ask you to show me the great things that God has caused to be written unto Ephraim, not Judah, the great things of his law. And if you get unsearching, come back, and maybe we'll agree this is it right here. Because I believe it. So states, and the history and all the evidence that we have so proclaims. Now, but they were counted as a strange thing. What was counted? This was counted as a strange thing. Well, I can sort of understand why, because I've had people come to me, well, how'd you get this book, Joe? I mean, once I tell them I believe in the Book of Mormon, so how'd it come about? Well, I tell them about Joseph Smith, you know, and his experience. Well, where are the plates now? Oh, an angel came to pick them up. That's what I thought. That sounds very funny to me. That's pretty strange, you know. And I say, well, let's just look it over here a little bit. Now, it might not be too strange in terms of how God works, because let's see how he's worked in the past. Now, there was a man named Moses, and God spoke to Moses out of a burning bush. And he said, you go down there to Egypt, and you do certain things. And Moses said, well, now those people are not going to believe me. Who am I going to tell sent me? And that sort of thing, you know. And, you know, some of them, I guess, just wondered. They thought, that's pretty strange. You coming down here to tell us you've been talking to the bush, it's on fire and didn't burn up and all. Oh, that's pretty funny. That's pretty funny. And then we go and we find John the Revelator, you know, and John the Revelator wasn't too popular in terms of the government in his days, and they just shipped him right off to an island. And there he's out there all alone, and he had some visions, and in those visions, there's some things that we just have difficulty in understanding. Had beasts and horns and stars and bitter water and black horses and people riding them looking like ghosts and all kinds of things, you know. And he comes to us and he says, God told me all this. And you know, today we just follow that right up. We don't even ask John the Revelator, who was your witness? We don't even think that that's strange, you know, that God worked that way then. And when God sent his son into the world, King of Kings, mind you, he was born in a barn. King of Kings. Well, we call it a stable, just for emphasis, he was born in a barn. Now, that's a little strange, isn't that a little strange for the King of Kings to be born in? And then he gets out and wanders around the countryside and finally comments to one of his disciples, I don't even have a place to lay my head. And he picks up a few sailors and some other folks, and then the town folks thought that was a little strange, you know, for King of Kings to act, because he kind of, and they accused his mother of being, just a worship woman. History states that the mother of Christ had the honorable occupation of taking in clothes and washing them for a living. And all of this seemed very strange. Just as it seems strange to us today that Joseph Smith, you know, got in trouble with the law and he was in jail and this happened and that happened. It's very strange. But, you know, God has worked in strange ways in the past. And so, let me say this in conclusion, because there's a lot more that we could cover as to why we believe. Let me illustrate it this way. There is a man now, a member of this Church of Christ. I guess he believes he's a pretty brilliant man, so do I. And 30-something years ago, he decided to prove to his wife, there wasn't a thing in this Book of Mormon. And he felt all he had to do was investigate it, check out everything it had to say and try to relate it in terms of history, anything else, and just point by point prove to his wife that, we just don't know what it's all about, that God hadn't spoken to us, he hadn't visited or anything else. Now, he spent 30 years trying to prove this to his wife, and at the end of the 30 years, he did exactly the opposite thing he set out to do. He proved to himself it was true. Yeah, what I'm saying is we have a member now of this church that spent 30 years that believed that he had to know how to prove that it was wrong. And he spent 30 years of his life very diligently trying to prove to his wife it was wrong, and he proved to himself that it was correct. There have been many men in our day and age that has tried to pick this apart. You know, I'm going to point this one thing out, and then I'm going to sit down. I remember one detail, and all of these things are so very meaningful unto me, because men just seek out that when they're trying to tear something down, they'll seek out every little point, names and places and so forth. You remember the story where Nephi, this book tells us that Nephi and his party, Lehi and so forth, started down into the wilderness and down along there, and he hadn't gotten to the water yet. And finally, Nephi broke his bow. He had a steel bow, and he hunted for a living. And they relied upon Nephi to go out and get food with that steel bow. And he was out there one day, and he broke that bow. And it wasn't too long, people began to get hungry, and they began to complain. And Nephi made it a matter of prayer, and then finally he wandered out in the wilderness, this book tells us there, and he searched out a piece of wood, and he made himself a bow. And then he used that bow to go hunt with, and the people were fed again. But here's the point. It just so happens, that particular geographical location right there that this describes is one of the few places on this 8,000 mile diameter ball on which we live, called the earth, that has suitable wood for making a bow. Now, isn't that strange? And you can just take the evidence and you can search it and try to pick it apart. And you know, if you search it, and if you ask God, you might set out to prove it's wrong, but you're going to prove to yourself it's true. I pray, God, that not only you who have not yet embraced the fullness of the gospel of Christ will get busy and dig for that treasure. There is treasure to be had. And when you find it, it's going to change your life. If you're a golfer, you're not going to like to play golf as much as you used to, because there's going to be some other things that you're going to enjoy more. And by the way, that's very strange too, because there was a time in my life when I didn't think I would ever enjoy anything more than participate in some kind of sport. And isn't it strange that Joe Kidd today would rather sit in a church, travel many miles, and maybe do a little reunion, to a dozen people, hear a few testimonies, hear a sermon or something, and enjoy that more than some of these other things. That is strange, but that is the rebirth. That makes new creatures of us. And that's a personal testimony to me that not only these records are true, but God is true, and that he changes the desires and the hearts and the minds of people. Oh, I still enjoy some other things, but nothing so much so as going up to the house of the Lord. May God bless us all.